When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons, from tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond. Every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Cha-ching! That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Girl, the thing.
Attention, my whole dress.
Girl, great gowns.
Girl,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed. No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast.
Shall we just get straight into bad news?
Play the theme.
Only on Every Outfit.
I feel like we need to do a bad news stinger count. Like, I don't think last year we used it as much as we have used it this year.
Yeah, it does seem like it's happening more and more often. So this week we lost Dolly Parton, which felt quite abrupt, I think, for everyone.
Yeah, it's interesting. I came across that video that I guess she had posted back in May where she said that she wasn't feeling as well and she was taking a step back. I saw that the day before she died for whatever reason, and then boom.
Yeah, it felt abrupt for me because I've seen her on The View pretty recently. Because she did that rock album that she was promoting last year, I think, and she went on The View. We also saw her on The Kardashians.
Yeah, Dolly Parton, I think it's clear, is just an omnipresent force, at least in our lives, as someone that we just saw multiple times a year, whether it was on talk shows, performing, just generally being a delight in this bleak, bleak world.
Yeah, she's obviously extremely talented, but like the persona was almost even more major because she was like a caricature of herself, intentionally so. She obviously crafted this really, really heightened look for herself and had this very sharp, quick sense of humor. But there was always that underlying humanity and goodness to this woman that I think everyone felt and always felt.
So Dolly Parton passed away at 80 after a, quote, brief battle with cancer. As always, fuck cancer.
Fuck cancer. Obviously, this has caused mass sadness. I think Dolly Parton is one of the few people in this world that pretty much everyone can agree on, regardless of political affiliation, geography, taste.
Yeah, I think what really proved that was the day it was announced that she had passed away. The DSA and Donald Trump both wrote tweets that were eulogizing Dolly Parton. So she brought both sides of the aisle, the most extremes, together. And we've gotten a lot of wonderful anecdotes about Dolly Parton, some that we knew, some that we didn't know, and just a wide swath of people eulogizing Dolly Parton, whether it's Eminem.
Okay, can we talk about that? Because that was one of my favorite posts about Dolly Parton. He posted a letter that she had written to him after she had seen him perform at, what was it?
I believe he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's what I thought, but then I was like, why was Eminem inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I mean, Dolly Parton was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
She seems more rock than Eminem, though. But anyway, she wrote him the sweetest letter that was basically like, I loved your performance. I hoped that I would get to meet you. I always felt that I was connected to you in some way. Like, imagine receiving that letter from Dolly Parton. And Eminem basically said, like, this meant so much to me. How could it not?
Of course. People have been reposting the clip of when she lost an Oscar to 3-6 Mafia. That infamous 2006 Academy Awards, but she couldn't have been more delightful, clapping. She sent a note to 3-6 Mafia saying, you know, you did good for Tennessee. I think personally, my favorite subgenre of posts would be straight men who either did work with Dolly Parton or didn't, talking about how much this woman meant to them. Sylvester Stallone posted a video. They starred in, what was it, Rhinestone?
I don't know. I never saw that.
I think it's time we watch it. But I was particularly taken with Vin Diesel's post about Dolly Parton.
Oddly enough, Vin Diesel maybe has the best Dolly Parton post. He just posted this audio.
I should stay. I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I will think of you each step of the way.
Okay, I've had enough.
It goes on for 30 seconds more. He gets to the chorus. But yes, Vin Diesel's tribute to Dolly Parton was singing his own rendition of I Will Always Love You.
Why not?
Jack White is on tour currently. He sang his version of Jolene. That makes sense because since the White Stripe days, he's been doing a cover of Jolene. Vin Diesel wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, I saw that Harry Styles played, I think, I Will Always Love You, one of his shows. Pitbull also did an incredible tribute. Just projected a photo of Dolly at one of his shows, a photo of Pitbull and Dolly, and then had all of these sexy female dancers jamming out to 9 to 5.
Well, I saw this TikTok that brought to my attention brand new information for me. Pitbull and Dolly Parton made a song together.
To mine.
Thank you, Dolly.
Mama worked hard her entire life. She had 12 kids at 35. Woo! Working 24/7, 365. Working 5 to 9 and 9 to 5.
That's incredible. Wow.
Okay, I guess it comes from a 2024 song they did together called Powerful Women.
How did we miss this?
I don't know. This feels very important.
Also, of course, when I heard of her passing, I immediately thought of Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin and how heartbroken they must be. The fact that there's only two remaining cast members from 9 to 5 is extremely depressing.
Didn't we semi-recently discuss the fact that they were trying to do a sequel to 9 to 5?
I don't remember talking about that, but I don't doubt it. It's weird that they didn't.
Misogyny, man. And now we'll never get a 9 to 5 sequel. I have seen a lot of videos that have photos of our favorite women of a certain age. Meryl Streep, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin. I'm trying to think of some others, but it's like, stay inside your homes.
Seriously. But 9 to 5 was a big part of her legacy because it was this overtly feminist film starring this woman that looked like a Barbie, not the sort of picture of a feminist, shall we say, certainly at that time. And even though she never really identified with that movement, that film, her music spoke volumes. I mean, particularly 9 to 5, which is about sexism, is about workers' rights, exploitation, what have you. And I always love the detail that she wrote that song, or she found the sort of beat to that song by rubbing her acrylic nails together while she was on set, just like waiting to get in front of the camera.
That's incredible.
It was like a Is the mic picking that up? I'm trying to do it with my nails.
It is indeed.
It's just crazy that, like, this woman was so pure and didn't let fame turn her into this, like, detached, delusional monster, which happens to so many celebrities.
If anything, it brought out the best in her, which you are correct. It does not usually happen when people get very, very worldwide famous, as she became. And she was never embittered. They played an old, I think it was a 60 Minutes interview, where she was being asked about, is she jealous of the fact that people now connote the song I Will Always Love You with Whitney Houston? She goes, no, I don't miss it. And there's another moment, I guess she was on Letterman, where she's like, not really, it made me $6 million. And then it also came out that she reinvested that in her community.
Yeah, well, her philanthropy in general went beyond the scope of a normal celebrity. She obviously came from a very poor rural background. She didn't forget where she came from. She did a lot of work around literacy, you know, a lot of philanthropy in Tennessee, specifically a lot of disaster relief.
Literacy, I just learned that she has a book program for young children, which I'm gonna submit. Like, you put in your address and you get a book every month for your child, which I think is beautiful. You know, the last time we spoke about her, we were talking about the Dolly Parton truck stop that recently opened.
Oh yeah, oh my God. I'm sure that's like a shrine at this point.
We gotta go. We always talked about going to Dollywood, and now is the time, I feel.
I actually once drove up to the gates of Dollywood, but I was too violently ill to go inside, unfortunately. I came this close, maybe one day.
I think that day is today, Chelsea. After we record, we're gonna get in the car and we're gonna drive straight to Dollywood. Support for today's episode comes from Square, and today we want to talk to our listeners who have beauty businesses, because Square is the system behind so many beauty businesses you already love. Whether you're a solo stylist, a barber, a nail artist, or running a full salon, you know success is about more than keeping your calendar full. It's about building loyal clients who keep coming back. Square helps bring the business side together, from appointments and payments to customer information reporting, so beauty pros can stay organized, deliver a great client experience, and keep growing.
Yes. While we may not have a beauty business, we have been using Square for nearly a decade. They've been with us as we've scaled our merch business, and we would have been lost without it on our last tour.
Anyone who runs a small business knows the hell that it is having to use different apps or systems to just run your company. You have your system for payments, another for payroll, another for inventory, and yet another one for online orders. It's a mess. However, Square gives you one connected system to handle it all.
Because appointments, payments, and customer information are connected, owners can better understand their clients and what keeps them coming back. As the business grows, Square grows with it without adding unnecessary complexity.
Here's a real seller stat. Businesses using Square Online earn 36% more revenue on average. We use Square for our business, and I bet if we had a beauty business, we would use Square for that as well. Which, Chelsea, if we had a beauty business, what kind of beauty business would we have?
I've always secretly wanted to give people eyelash extensions.
Oh, okay.
Like, when I get mine done, I'm actually like kind of jealous of the person doing it.
Well, maybe we should do that and use Square. If you're starting a business or running one that deserves better tools, Square helps you sell, manage, and grow without slowing down. Right now, you can get up to $200 off Square hardware at square.com/go/outfit. That is SQUARE.com/go/outfit. Run your business smarter with Square. Get started today.
Wait, also, didn't Dolly Parton like partially fund the research for the COVID vaccine, the Moderna one, which made me think, like, which one did we get? Because we got the vax together.
Yes, we did. You made us drive to another county so that we could get it.
Us drive to another county. We definitely weren't one of the first people. It was just like the only place we could get an appointment.
We were talking about this before we recorded. You were like, Dolly Parton brought both sides of the aisle together, like all this outpouring of love. No one has anything bad to say about her. And then I showed you a tweet that was like, Dolly Parton did fund the COVID vaccine. I'm not saying that killed her. I just, you know, it's interesting.
God.
A lot of fuckats have slid into our DMs and my personal DMs to be like, just in case you didn't know, Lauren, Dolly Parton helped produce and was an uncredited producer on the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I knew, forgot, and then remembered thanks to you guys.
Now you know again.
Now I know again. The world is just a bit bleaker. And that's where the week started.
The world is bleaker, but also I'm scared, like, was she the glue holding America together at this point? Is shit gonna go south now that she's gone?
I mean, I had this thought when both David Bowie and Prince passed away the year that Trump got elected. That felt like a harbinger for things to come of basically this last 10 years. But yeah, I think this might be the second harbinger.
Yeah.
Now, Chelsea, I don't know if you know this. My middle name is Cassandra. My parents always joke about how I've been able to predict the future. But I want to shout out this other Cassandra I saw on TikTok called Catch Up by Triceratops. Great name. Who shortly after Dolly Parton's death posted this.
Tim Curry, look at me in the goddamn eyes. I know you were only born a few months after her. If you die, I will kill you.
Did this woman kill Tim Curry?
I think she might have. That's so fucked up. What are the odds?
Because not 24 hours later was it announced that Tim Curry, also 80 years old, had passed away.
Horrifying. A horrifying time for gay people specifically.
I have seen on Twitter this being referred to as gay 9/11.
I think that's fair. Although, to be fair, Tim Curry never did publicly identify as gay. He always resisted being labeled in that way. But the roles that he played in the movies that he was in certainly spoke volumes.
So Tim Curry in 2012 suffered a stroke, which I did not realize happened on a massage table. And it was the massage therapist who recognized the signs and called the ambulance.
Seems like you could be in a worse place when you have a stroke. And this stroke resulted in him losing the ability to walk, losing the ability to talk for a period of time. He had to learn how to speak again. Horrible. I saw a video of him, I feel like it was like a couple years ago, at some sort of Rocky Horror fan event or something. He looked very frail. It was sad.
On the one hand, I'm happy that he's no longer suffering. I agree. I've seen videos of him the past few years. He's gone to various fan events looking very frail. But also, you know, the past 14, 15 years post-stroke, it's made me so sad about what his career could have been, because you know he would have killed it during the streaming era.
I would hope so. I feel like his movies were certainly so important to our generation. Rocky Horror.
Clue
is huge. Home Alone 2, of course. The Home Alone 2 rewatch is going to be really depressing this year.
Well, yeah, because it's Catherine O'Hara. The Pigeon Lady passed away this year as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Now Tim Curry. And yet, not a certain other person who makes a cameo in Home Alone 2. It's never him. It's never him.
I think the Grim Reaper might be MAGA.
Yeah, I think the Grim Reaper is just a little diva who lives for the drama.
Imagine just like lying on your deathbed and the Grim Reaper like creeps up and he's wearing like a Let's Go Brandon shirt.
Oh, wow. I forgot about Let's Go Brandon.
He's wearing the gold Trump sneakers like under his Grim Reaper cape.
Well, hopefully the Grim Reaper didn't come for Dolly Parton and Tim Curry. Hopefully they had like a beautiful celestial being that like brought them up to the heavens.
Yeah. Here's hoping. But like back to Home Alone 2, like I feel like there was gay subtext there. Like his character was gay. It wasn't stated. But during that scene where he comes into Macaulay Culkin's hotel room and like Macaulay Culkin is doing that whole grift where he's playing like a gangster movie to like impersonate the sound of an adult's voice. And the gangster from the movie says like, I caught you smooching my brother. And he has this look on his face like, fuck, like I'm being outed, which is such like a small and like little thing. But like those kind of things, even if you can't like fully understand the subtext, I feel like that kind of shit affects you when you see someone like that as a kid, you know? And also Rocky Horror. I mean, Rocky Horror is so important to the gay community. And his transvestite character wasn't the butt of the joke. He was actually kind of the coolest person in the movie.
Oh, God, yeah. Sorry, my mind can't get past the idea of gay representation in Home Alone 2.
Well, again, I think it's subtext with the character. But also with Rocky Horror, I feel like just because of the cultish nature around that movie and all of the midnight screenings and stuff, I feel like there were a lot of men that dressed in drag or, you know, closeted trans women that dressed according to their gender that, you know, wouldn't have dressed like that in the streets that sort of could do that at Rocky Horror. And also, like, Rocky Horror was such a thing, like, if you were underage and, like, weren't old enough to go to a gay bar, you could, like, go to Rocky Horror.
Oh, yeah, it was such a thing.
His impact. I also have always thought that Annie is vaguely gay, like the musical version with Carol Burnett and Bernadette Peters. He's great in that. I was obsessed with that movie when I was growing up.
Right, and he played Pennywise the Clown in the TV movie adaptation of it.
That I missed.
That I missed as well. I feel like not enough is spoken about the fact that he is one of the villains, a red herring villain, in Charlie's Angels, the first film.
See, I only saw that once, so I'm not that familiar with the Charlie's Angels movies, but Clue, I don't know why millennials are so obsessed with Clue.
I don't know, because it is particular to our generation, because I feel like if you talk to a Gen X person, they do not get this movie.
It's specific to our generation, but also it was like set in the 50s. Like, why did we care?
I think because it was on Comedy Central all the time growing up.
Yeah. And he was so good in that. How did you sleep last night, my love?
Pretty good. What about you?
I slept great, like a dream, in fact. And that's probably because I recently upgraded to Casper's Dream Mattress and it lives up to the title.
Well, Casper does make reliable, high-quality mattresses designed to deliver consistent, comfortable sleep night after night. Casper's mattresses are highly rated by Consumer Reports, and out of 99 mattresses, Consumer Report named Casper's the one mattress their top-rated all-foam mattress of 2026.
What I love about my Casper mattress is that it's a hybrid mattress that helps solve tossing and turning. It pairs responsive springs with ergonomic support zones so the dream keeps you aligned and dreaming all night. Honestly, I've never slept better.
If you've been talking about getting a new bed, now is the time with Casper's Labor Day sale. Head to Casper.com and save up to 30% on the mattress you deserve.
Casper's mattresses are built to be durable and long-lasting, so you're not replacing your mattress every few years. Their products are designed to withstand the test of time, maintaining support and comfort over the long haul.
And Casper has their 100-night risk-free trial, so you can give Casper's mattress a try risk-free. Although with 110,000-plus five-star reviews, I'm sure you're going to love it like we do.
Remember, the day always ends well with Casper. Right now, save up to 30% on mattresses and up to 35% on everything else when you go to Casper.com. One last time, that is Casper.com, and save up to 30% on the mattress you deserve. He was also so good in Times Square, which you've never seen. This needs to be rectified immediately.
I know.
This is a coming-of-age film about two girls who escape from a mental institution and, like, start living together in an abandoned warehouse. They start a punk band together, and then Tim Curry plays, like, this cool DJ that starts playing their music, who appears throughout the film. In the original cut of the film, it was, like, more explicitly lesbian, but because it came out in 1980, all of that shit was cut out. But, like, the subtext is there, so it's another kind of very queer movie that he was in. And similarly to Rocky Horror, it's like these characters are very much, like, rebelling against the idea of, like, a conventional life or whatever.
And then I completely forgot that he originated the role of King Arthur in Spamalot, which did you ever see?
I never saw Spamalot.
Well, Tim Curry, you will be missed. And as the saying goes, death does indeed come in threes.
I fucking can't. Death has also come from Yayoi Kusama, who was 97.
She lived all of the life.
I'm surprised she lived that long, just given, like, the fact that she's been living in a mental institution for 10,000 years. Like, obviously that shit can affect your lifespan.
Not hers.
Not hers. But I guess she now won't have to keep designing all of those Louis Vuitton collections. I always was kind of a little iffy on the ethics of getting a 90-year-old woman in a mental institution to do all of that.
I didn't want to say that because I didn't want to be crass, but my mind did go to the fact of like, oh, now it's just going to be her estate perennially licensing her artwork to various people.
Well, I think her estate like may have been doing that already, you know? We don't actually know how involved she was with any of that stuff.
Yeah, we talked about this when that Vuitton collaboration came out. Probably not that involved. I guess we will get a better answer in the coming years to see how many collaborations happen through her estate.
Yeah. It's crazy how she's just like the artist that was like made for Instagram because she does all these very like immersive installations. Obviously, all of that work predates Instagram by decades.
Oh, yes. You're talking about the Museum of Ification that really took over Instagram in the 2010s.
Totally. Like the amount of times that we would see selfies in the Infinity Room at the Broad.
I'm guilty of that.
I'm guilty of it, too. You can't not.
Right, the Infinity Room, of course. I thought you were talking about the fact that her aesthetic, the polka dots, the immersive exhibitions, as you hinted at, feels like it gave way to the Museum of Ice Cream, the Museum of Broken Relationships.
Oh, totally. I'm so glad people aren't doing that shit anymore. Or maybe they are.
I think it was one of the good things that COVID killed.
Right. But then there's still, you know, like the Willy Wonka experience and like that sort of thing.
Are you talking about the sad Scottish one from a few years ago?
Yeah, but that was an attempt at that, you know?
It's harder than it looks.
All right, shall we move on to the living?
Absolutely. We have women of a certain age news. I guess women who are still with us of a certain age news.
Blessedly.
We need to wrap these women in bubble wrap.
So the last time we talked about our beloved West Hollywood, we discussed the sinkhole. The sinkhole has since been repaired, but last week we got an even more gripping story, which was the tale of Wilbur, the runaway pig.
Well, the WeHo pig.
The WeHo pig.
That the internet dubbed Wilbur. Fascinating. I started sending you these videos a couple weekends ago. It started with Jamal Harrison, who posted a video on TikTok of him riding an e-bike and seeing this runaway baby piglet. And then all throughout Saturday on TikTok, people kept seeing this pig.
Someone finally caught the pig. The pig ended up in an animal shelter.
The West Los Angeles Animal Shelter.
No one came to claim the pig.
Yeah, I think the story has a happy ending, which we will get to, but I think the most distressing thing is there's no information about how this little piglet got loose. They've determined that Wilbur is 11 weeks and weighs about 17 pounds.
He's so, so cute. And I've been obsessed with this story. KTLA has been covering it religiously. And a lot of people wanted to adopt this pig. So they had a silent auction. And who won the silent auction? Miss Diane Warren.
Who did press for winning this silent auction.
So the last time we talked, I believe, is when I lost my 17th Oscar, and I kind of made history as the biggest loser. But today, today's for a different reason. I won a pig.
America, you may know me as the biggest loser, but today I'm the biggest winner because I won Wilbur the WeHo pig.
Diane Warren has an animal sanctuary in Malibu, which is exactly what I would do if I had Diane Warren money.
For those who only know Diane Warren as the woman who looks like she wants to murder Billie Eilish, when Billie Eilish wins an Oscar instead of her, she has written songs like Cher's If I Could Turn Back Time, Aerosmith's I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, which is how she is able to afford an animal sanctuary, which is called Mouse Butt Rescue Ranch. Do you know why it's called Mouse Butt Rescue Ranch? I went down a rabbit hole.
I do not know.
So it is called Mouse Butt Rescue Ranch in honor of her late cat Mouse and her parrot named Butt Wings.
Don't love that.
The property is now home to, this is according to an interview she did in 2017, so there may be more, but at the time it was home to 7 donkeys, 2 mini donkeys, 5 horses, 2 mini horses. I like how she's like, I'm getting full size and the fun size. 15 goats, 4 pigs, 6 dogs, 15 chickens, 2 turkeys, and roughly 2 dozen mostly elderly cats saved from the euthanasia list.
What an angel, this woman.
Well, I love the background of this story because actually who won the pig was a woman named Marcia Zwilling, who represents the Diane Warren Foundation. And I would love to be a fly on the wall because this woman, Marcia, was explaining that Diane Warren was blowing up her phone all weekend being like, you better win me this pig.
Of course.
I assume the silent auction is to fund the West Los Angeles Animal Shelter.
This is truly like the one story that brings me joy in this life. And I'm so glad that this beautiful pig has a fabulous home.
Of course. So I went to look up Mouse Butt Rescue Ranch, and they do not have an official website, but they do have a Facebook page because, of course, they have a Facebook page, which they update semi-regularly. And they did give an update this week about Wilbur, saying, we have had many requests from Diane's friends to come to the ranch to see Wilbur. We are going to hold off on all visits for a few months. I thought it was going to be weeks, as we need him to settle in and feel secure. He gets nervous around people he doesn't know. Too many strangers will scare him and undo our process, as he is still wary of strangers because of people running after him trying to catch him. Thank you for understanding.
Aww.
Oh, Chelsea, I did also see a few years ago for charity, they did auction off a tour of Mouse Butt Rescue Ranch. So I feel like we should be on the lookout to win one of those.
I only want that if Diane Warren is leading the tour, though.
I did see for that auction that Diane Warren did donate that. So maybe we'd see her there.
Dear listener, as of late, I have to say, I've been looking a tad more haggard. Despite this humid Los Angeles summer and layering multiple moisturizers, my makeup was looking cakey, which is a bummer because I needed the makeup on account of looking so haggard. Skin changes as we age, and especially during perimenopause and menopause. It can feel like it's changing faster than you can keep up with. Drier, thinner, more reactive, less resilient. Then I started using Oak Essentials Moisture Rich Balm. She's thick and buttery, but melts right into your skin. Never greasy or heavy. It leaves your skin with that healthy, dewy glow that makes you look like you've gotten a full night's sleep. That's thanks to ingredients like sea buckthorn, barrage seed, and coconut oils, which help support collagen production while deeply nourishing the skin and helping support the skin barrier. Oak Essentials was actually founded by Jenny Kane as her own skin started to shift in her 40s. She was looking for real solutions that supported aging skin without invasive procedures or a 12-step routine. I have so many Jenny Kane products, from clothes to homeware and candles, and if you know her world, you know the aesthetic. Effortless, elevated, nothing extra. And Oak Essentials follows that model. In a one-week consumer study, 100% of participants said their skin felt instantly hydrated, deeply nourished, and noticeably softer. And the study participants ranged from 24 to 74, so whether your skin is just starting to shift or has been through it, this product works. The Moisture Rich Balm was my gateway product, but now I'm exploring the whole Oak Essentials range, from the Luminous Body Lotion to the Dew Body Butter and their Microbiome Balance deodorant. But their Moisture Rich Balm is Oak Essentials' bestseller, and once you try it, you'll understand why. Head to oakessentials.com and use code OUTFIT for 15% off your first order at checkout. That's 15% off your order at oakessentials.com with promo code OUTFIT. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about us, so please support the show and let them know we sent you.
Moving on, there's this big Disney fan event called D23 that I've never heard of in my life until this past couple of weeks.
This is my favorite thing. Just a peek behind the podcast curtain is we have a doc where we kind of put things like, oh, maybe we'll talk about this, maybe we'll talk about this. And I saw Chelsea put all of these things that she wanted to talk about. And then only 2 days ago, we were like, wait, this all happened at the same Disney event? The answer is yes. What is more puzzling is this Disney event takes place in Anaheim. That's not the puzzling part, but a week after Comic-Con. So they do a certain amount of announcements at Comic-Con, especially for things like Marvel, because Disney now owns Marvel. But then the following weekend, they do it again.
But this actually seemed pretty fab, because Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino made an appearance in character as Romy and Michelle. They divulged that their characters still own a store in Beverly Hills, which we were wondering about. I was a little bit scared by the costuming, though. It seemed a little more Legally Blonde to me.
It did.
Like, Mira Sorvino was wearing silver ankle boots. And I know that Mona May, who was the costume designer for Romy and Michelle, is doing the sequel. But I don't know if she's responsible for this. I hope not.
That could have just been a Disney-approved stylist. Well, we're getting a Romy and Michelle announcement because Disney bought Fox. And Romy and Michelle is a 20th Century Fox movie. Now, 20th Century Studios, I did notice that this film will not get a theatrical release. It will be coming out on streaming, which also makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, that's depressing.
So they still have the store, but because they've been so focused on keeping their independent brand thriving for nearly 40 years, they have not found love.
So I guess What's-Her-Face is broken up with Alan Cumming.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what that backstory is, because when this movie was announced, it was noted that Alan Cumming is coming back, Janine Garofalo is coming back. If anything, I would have thought the story would be the reverse, that they don't have their store anymore. They're married, perhaps divorced now, and they want to get back to the Romy and Michelle boutique, which seems more realistic.
Or it's like their 30th, 40th reunion.
Well, yes, you are correct. When we did discuss this movie initially, I was like, oh, okay, so it's just going to be them going back to their 40th reunion, which could still be on the table.
We don't know.
This movie is coming out next year in 2027.
D23 also featured an appearance from Glenn Close in character as Cruella. I would die if I saw that in real life.
So when did you figure out that this was a Disney fan event? Because the more curious thing about Glenn Close appearing at D23 was when I first saw the image, I was like, oh, okay, you know, they're doing Romy and Michelle, they're doing Hocus Pocus 3, we're getting another 101 Dalmatians sequel. So I guess 103 Dalmatians, and they're bringing Glenn Close back. Genius. No. Do you know what she was there to announce?
Yes, she's getting a ride at Disney World because they have some sort of villains land, apparently. I've never been to Disney World.
Yes, she was there to announce new details for its highly anticipated Villains Land expansion, which is set to feature at least 13 classic villains in a storyline involving a mysterious wishing well that courts the iconic baddies to its borders in pursuit of harnessing its dark powers. Give me that movie. Don't waste it on the theme park. You're making all of these sequels and prequels that no one asked for. Like, did you see the Emma Stone one?
Yeah.
That is the Cruella origin story.
I liked that one.
Give me the Avengers, but with all of the Disney female villains teaming up together.
Yeah, would watch.
Anyway, they got Glenn Close back.
They got Glenn back. Also, speaking of women of a certain age, or perhaps Bull Dykes of a certain age, our dear friend Lea Delaria, her school bus character from one of the Cars movies, I forget which one that was, is also getting its own ride at Disney World, which is so fun.
Disneyland gets nothing?
Yeah, I know, right? Like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to Orlando?
Yes, correct. It's in Orlando.
Although we probably should.
I mean, because I have a child, I'm sure at some point we will end up going to Orlando. I foresee a lot of Every Outfit sponsored trips. I mean, this trip we've already got two, right? We got Dollywood and now we have to go to this Villains Land in Disney World. But since we're talking about D23, I do want to bring to your attention another announcement that happened during the Marvel panel. So the Lukes in the audience, and probably some fuckettes will care about this, but to explain to you, Chelsea, they are rebooting the X-Men, finally. We're getting a new X-Men cast.
Okay, what was the old cast?
Those films directed by now-canceled director Bryan Singer. You had Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. Those are the Hugh Jackman ones with Anna Paquin, Rebecca Romijn. You might be confused because I'm sure you've seen the new Avengers Doomsday trailer where all of those people I just mentioned, or most of those people I mentioned, make an appearance in the Avengers Doomsday trailer because the multiverse has been unleashed.
Oh, God. This sounds horrible.
Anyway, it is widely anticipated that that film will open the door for this new cast of X-Men, of which they finally made the announcements. And I just want to bring to your attention that Christopher Abbott will be playing Professor X, and Adam Driver will be playing a character, and this is even too nerdy for me, a man named Mr. Sinister. But many elder millennials have pointed out that this is...
girls.
The boyfriends of girls are reuniting. Because also, Desi, Eben Moss Baccarat, is in the new Fantastic Four film.
Wow.
So we've got three of the four major boyfriends. People joked about how, what, is Ray going to play Magneto?
Would love if Ray entered into this world. Not that I'm ever going to watch any of this shit.
No, and people have also pointed out that Adam Driver, who, since he was Kylo Ren in the Star Wars films, has mostly been doing director-driven, mostly independent films, that this may be the biggest recession indicator that Adam Driver is back in a sort of Disney-owned property. Now, when we originally conceived of this episode, it was going to be a happy episode because we were going to lead with the fact that Rosie O'Donnell has hosted Kimmel last week, and it just made all of our lives, I think, better. And then a bunch of people we cared about died, so we had to talk about that first.
I know. This was the absolute best. It brought so much comfort and joy into my life. I forgot about the fact that, like, a late night show, in theory, is that place where you kind of, like, unwind. Like, that's how I used to feel when I watched Conan when I was in high school, you know, but I don't really watch late night talk shows anymore. So it was just really nice watching a late night show consistently for four nights in a row. And Rosie was just so perfect. I really expected her to more sort of conform to Kimmel and how his show was, but she completely took it over, made it exactly like the Rosie O'Donnell show.
So I have a question about that, because you watched it live each night. I watched clips on YouTube. I did notice in her opening monologue, she referenced the koosh balls. Did she throw koosh balls into the audience?
No koosh balls. There's no koosh balls, but she did, like, have a bunch of toys on her desk. She did stuff like she brought on this, like, 3-year-old girl who sang a song from Frozen, like, stuff that just felt typical of the Rosie O'Donnell show. She did a lot of material, which I believe is also from her new, like, one-woman show. So she was telling a lot of sort of personal stories, family stories. And it just reminds you of all the reasons why we love her and also how good she is at interviewing celebrities.
Not just interviewing celebrities, but just interviewing anyone. Like, she does have this magical ability to just kind of get on the frequency of whatever guest is in front of her.
Yeah.
Like, obviously she has a lot of affinity with someone like Jean Smart. She knows Megan Mullally. But with someone like Janelle James, she asked her because they both had a stand-up background, her early stand-up days.
Yeah, and she's a fan. She watches the shows that they're talking about. You know, I don't even get the sense that most of these guys that host these shows are necessarily fans of any of this shit. You know, the way that she was talking to Richard Gadd about Baby Reindeer and about his newer show that I didn't watch.
A Half Man, which is just incredibly dark. I couldn't do that to myself. But according to Rosie, it's great.
And yeah.
It was so scary that she had to watch it during the daytime.
The summer season is coming to an end, although it doesn't feel that way, as this week here in Los Angeles has been the hottest it's been all summer. And when it's hot outside, I need my hair off my neck. I used to feel self-conscious about how my hair looked in these styles, but after using Nutrafol, I've noticed a real difference in how I feel about my hair. Instead of worrying about it, I can pull it back and get on with my day knowing it looks healthy, full, and beautiful. I have been using Nutrafol for years. For the last year or so, I was taking their postpartum formula, but now I'm back to their women's formula to help with shedding. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand, and it's the number one hair growth supplement brand personally used by dermatologists. Everyone's root cause of hair thinning is different, so a one-size-fits-all approach to hair growth doesn't cut it. That's why Nutrafol has multiple formulas that are tailored to give your hair what it needs to grow throughout different stages, such as postpartum and menopause, as well as for different lifestyles, such as plant-based diets. Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF-certified for sport and clinically tested. Let your hair be one less thing to worry about. See visibly thicker, stronger, faster growing hair in 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you visit Nutrafol.com and enter promo code OUTFIT. That's Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT.
But she's such a genuine fan that she was talking to the guy from the pit, who I reminded you is one of the high school students in the movie In and Out. But not only is she talking about the pit, but she's talking about a show that he was previously on called Animal Kingdom. And she's like, I love you in that role.
Yeah, exactly. It's nice when someone is a real connoisseur of culture in that way. And the guy from The Pit, I don't watch The Pit, but he was absolutely lovely. He was obviously very excited to be interviewed by Rosie, was a fan of hers. So that was one of the better interviews.
Yes, if I may be so bold, I don't think she got the best guest.
No. And I just saw that Stevie Nicks performed this week.
For Jelly Rolls Week. That's who's hosting this week.
I love it.
Another woman who currently needs to be wrapped in bubble wrap, Stevie Nicks.
She did Stand Back. That was nice. But like, I really hope that something comes of this Rosie thing. I think it's unlikely that she will host a late night show, but she needs to be interviewing people again. She needs to do something in the variety show format, even intermittently, like do a Christmas special or something, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and Daniel DeArdeo of Variety wrote an article where he was like, Rosie needs a late night show. And it's like, I think this was so good because Rosie isn't doing this week in and week out. Like, the obvious answer in these times is like, oh, Rosie should have a podcast. But I think what makes her so great is she is one of the few people that this format, the variety talk show format, works for. And the one thing that you cannot do in a podcast is have a cooking segment or have a little girl sing Frozen. So you're right. Netflix, someone, they need to give her a Christmas special.
Rosie O'Donnell actually did have a podcast recently, but she stopped doing it. It wasn't filmed. I forget what it was called. I listened to a couple episodes of it. Like, I listened to her interview Holland Taylor, which was delightful. But like, we need something from her.
And we recently did a VIP episode about the 30th anniversary of the Rosie O'Donnell Show. And in that episode, in researching it, I think the other reason that she's not going to go back to a talk show is one of the reasons she revealed, of all places, Page Six, why she stopped doing her show was she saw she had $100 million in the bank. And I think because she
after 6 years, like, that's crazy. And it's crazy that that show was only on for 6 years. I mean, 6 years feels like an eternity when you're a kid.
No, but I thought that her show was on for at least a decade. I didn't realize it was that short. It obviously made a huge impact on our lives. And thanks to other obsessive elder millennials, you can basically watch the entirety of that show thanks to one person on YouTube who just VHS recorded every episode.
Yeah. And because we did so much Rosie research for that Patreon episode, my feed is so Rosie. And it's really nice. It honestly makes social media a more enjoyable experience because the tone of it is so warm and positive, and it doesn't make me want to die.
But I think because she made so much money, she only does things that she wants to do. And that is an amazing freedom and luxury. But for that reason, I don't think she's going to slum it and go back to either daytime or a late night talk show. Because that format is dying?
Well, also, even can we get her in a movie or something? Like, I understand that, like, no one casts women of a certain age unless they're, like, Meryl Streep. But, like, we need that. She's such a good actress.
Going back to the guest that Rosie had, I did see the clip where she gave the entire audience confessions to.
Perfect.
Which is something that I so associate with daytime television. But I feel like we need to give people in the audience free shit. Like, I feel like that's something we need to bring back.
Absolutely. I forgot to mention this on our Rosie O'Donnell episode because I forgot it myself. But when I was living in New York, I randomly, like, a friend got tickets to, I think it was Jimmy Fallon. Rosie O'Donnell was the guest, and she gave the entire audience, it wasn't Guitar Hero, but it was DJ Hero. It was like the DJ version of Guitar Hero.
Yes, yes.
Which I then like sold on Craigslist. That's my story.
Do you remember?
So she's given me something.
Do you remember? Of course, the height of giving audience free shit was when Oprah gave a car to everyone. Do you remember at that time Tony Danza had a daytime talk show and he gave everyone who got a car from Oprah insurance for a year or something like that?
That's amazing. I also want to mention that she also gave the audience Miss Rachel dolls on a separate night. Extremely on brand for Rosie O'Donnell. Perfect.
Yeah, why couldn't she get Ms. Rachel? That's a perfect person for Rosie to interview.
That's true.
My life has been taken over by Ms. Rachel. Something I was aware of pre-having a child, but let me just tell you, Chelsea, I understood how popular this woman was, and I was like, okay, she's got a children's show. No wonder Ms. Rachel is so wealthy. These are the most low-budget videos, no disrespect, but it's just her against a green screen with, like, free stock footage.
I love it. See, another perfect guest for a very rosy Christmas.
No, but going back to her giving away copies of Confessions 2, I was like, oh yeah, of course, she called up Madonna and she's going to have Madonna on the show. No.
Well, I don't think she actually had any booking the guests, but also just like so cool to see her and Madonna thriving simultaneously in this moment. Just incredible.
So before we move on, I do want to ask you, because I've heard a bunch of hubbub, I've read tweets that talked about, is Rosie going to be on the 30th anniversary of The View? What is going on with this?
The last time I checked in with that, she said that she hadn't been asked. I don't know if anything has changed. Obviously, you know, there was a lot of drama when Rosie was on the show. Her and Whoopi Goldberg never got along. Rosie has said in other interviews that they have sort of mended fences in the intervening years, or like can tolerate each other at this point. But I think it would be doing a huge disservice to the show if they didn't include Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah, what I saw, I thought was, because Rosie's been doing a lot of press for her one-woman show and the 30th anniversary of her talk show, that she was like, yeah, I'm coming back for the 30th anniversary. And then The View rep was like, no, she's not. And then Rosie had to clarify and like, well, as a guest, I'm not coming back as a host.
Right. She did go on Anna Navarro's podcast recently, which I didn't listen to the whole thing. I listened to a bit of it, which was interesting because they have the shared connection of living in Miami and being close with Gloria Estefan.
Right, right, right.
So it was just kind of like stories from that period where Rosie used to live down there. And I would always see like paparazzi photos of her like riding a jet ski wearing Crocs.
What a life. And now she's in Ireland.
Shout out to our Irish listeners, if we have any.
We have a few. That much I know. Please let us know if you've run into Rosie. Okay, we're going to talk about a few movies. We had planned to talk about the Sex Purge movie, but because we did a Sex and the City episode last week and we were off the week before that, that film really came and went.
The moment has passed. We were waterboarded with that trailer for a period of time.
And now we never have to see that trailer again, but we did see a few movies, which we will talk about in a second. But I just want to ask you, did you get the trailer for this Robert Pattinson primetime film?
Of course. It looks like the best movie that's ever been made.
Okay, I'm going to be vulnerable for a second and just say that I remember this movie getting announced, but I had thought it was inspired by a fictionalization, a show like To Catch a Predator. He was playing someone like a Chris Hansen type. I did not realize till he literally says, I'm Chris Hansen. I'm like, oh, shit.
I got chills when he said, I'm Chris Hansen. Did you ever watch To Catch a Predator?
Oh, God, all the time.
Yeah, I watched it too. Not religiously, but I watched enough episodes to get a sense of the format and the vibe.
Yes. And I think we were surprised that this is actually a straightforward retelling of the creation of To Catch a Predator, the unseemly side, the need for Chris Hansen to be a respectable journalist and the lengths he will go to do that. But I don't think anyone was more surprised than Chris Hansen himself, who has been doing press since this trailer came out and is like, I had no idea about this movie. No one asked me.
That must feel insane.
Well, yeah. I mean, you watch that trailer, and if you did not know that this movie was getting made, you see that trailer and you're like, ooh, I'm probably not coming out looking great in this movie.
Right.
And he was recently on Jesse Walters, the Fox News host podcast or something, where he was discussing the fact that he was invited by A24 for a screening of Primetime ahead of its release. But they made him sign such a crazy NDA where he basically was going to have to give up all of his rights. This is according to Chris Hansen. A24 has not released a statement about this, that he refused. And a couple of days ago, The Hollywood Reporter reported that he has bought advertising time before every screening of Primetime that will air a commercial starring him. Now, that headline went everywhere. People did not click on the Hollywood Reporter article to read the article fully. I did, Chelsea. And what most people are missing is the Hollywood Reporter article has the actual commercial that Chris Hansen is going to put in front of Primetime. Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
I'm Chris Hansen, and I'm going to need everyone in the theater to take a seat right over there. You know, I've spent decades working with law enforcement to catch predators before they exploit our children. Now, there are more platforms than ever before where this disturbing crime is being committed, and we are there to take down the predators. Join us undercover every day on my streaming network, True Blue.
Okay, wait, you can just buy ads ahead of every movie? What? I've never seen an ad for anything but a movie before a movie.
Oh, no. I have noticed that they have been doing, well, one, I feel like a couple months ago, every time I went to a movie, it was just AI ad after AI ad after AI ad. I have now noticed that they've shifted. It's no longer like Maria Menounos giving you movie trivia. It'll be a straight up commercial for a product trailer, commercial for a product trailer.
See, I like pretty much only go to AMC, so they don't do that.
You got to get on that Lemley side of life. A Cinemark, perhaps? Anyway, let's not focus on the fact that you can now buy ad space in front of movies and how dark that is. I love that he's like, this is not me telling you that what you're about to see is fiction, nor is it me reflecting on maybe the amoral nature of the show I helped create, To Catch a Predator. No, it's me here to tell you that in that time since To Catch a Predator has gone off air, I've basically become a Twitch streamer, but for finding predators.
This is genius marketing. He's really smart for doing this.
Well, yeah, now I'm aware that he has a live, seemingly 24/7 channel that is dedicated to just catching various predators on different apps.
Wild. Well, can't wait for that movie. When does it come out?
September 24th.
Oh, wow.
It will premiere at the Venice Film Festival, and then it will be out at the end of September.
Gorgeous. Wow, what a run Robert Pattinson has had this year.
He better be nominated in Best Supporting Actor category and Best Actor category.
Yeah, he will be.
Can you imagine if he wins an Oscar for playing Chris Hansen?
That would be beautiful. And judging by this trailer, well-deserved.
Okay, so we saw two movies this week. Which one would you like to discuss first?
Let's start with Camp Miasma.
Teenage sex and death at Camp Miasma. Just rolls off the tongue. It actually does.
A little long and wordy, I think, but whatever.
What did you think of the film?
I really enjoyed this movie. It was deeply bizarre. I had absolutely no clue what was happening at a certain point. This film quite intentionally blurs the lines between fantasy and reality, but I respect the fact that it has such a strong point of view and this sort of mind that this came from.
This film was written and directed by Jane Schonbrunn, you know, a fellow person who spent their teenage years on Buffy the Vampire Slayer message boards and writing fan fiction. So in many ways, this is a film made for me. I will say, I don't think I understood the last 25 minutes of the movie.
No, not at all.
But I did overall like the film. I especially enjoyed the representation of hellish Zoom meetings with creative executives.
Yeah. Groundbreaking, actually, to see that in a film.
I feel like from Eddington to this film, you know, I always think about that Greta Gerwig quote where she's like, well, I'll never make a film where a cell phone is shown. And I think directors in the past year have really figured out how to make our increasingly social media, cell phone driven world cinematic.
Totally. This movie has a very distinctive look overall.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I wanted to get your thoughts about the opening of the film, which has brought back the opening credit sequence. There was a time in films for like the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years where it's like you got straight into the action. We didn't do opening title sequences anymore. And this was such an amazing use of that because it gave you the entire background and lore of the Camp Miasma series through media.
Yes. Camp Miasma is a horror franchise. And through ephemera and merch and press clippings and stuff for this movie, it tells the entire story of how it got popular, how, you know, it fell on hard times, how it became considered problematic.
And obviously, the writer-director is inspired by a mixture of Friday the 13th and also the Sleepaway Camp franchise. I don't know if you are aware of the twist in Sleepaway Camp.
Yes.
Okay. It's revealed that the girl is a boy. It is a film beloved by the queer community, but also much derided as it is seen as transphobic, which there's a storyline of that in Camp Miasma that I assume the director is inspired by Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, and just trans villains in horror movies in general. It touches upon so much because there's the commentary about how transness has been depicted in horror movies. It explores how sexuality can really be shaped by movies and things that we see as kids. It gets into the erotic quality of voyeurism and how that's kind of inherent to the movie-going experience.
And also a common trope in horror films, especially horror films of the 80s. You have the unseen killer usually watching the teenagers, the camp counselors having sex before he murders them.
Yeah, and I appreciated the sexuality of it. It was deeply weird, but kind of hot.
Oh, this is a very horny movie.
We don't get a ton of cinematic depictions of lesbian age gap relationships.
We should say that this film primarily stars Gillian Anderson and Hannah Einbinder. Gillian Anderson is the final girl from the first film, Billy Presley, who has become a recluse and somehow owns the location of the first Camp Miasma film. Hannah Einbinder plays the Sundance Wunderkind, who her runaway success at Sundance is a film that is psycho from the perspective of the shower curtain.
It's a character that is not dissimilar from her character in Hacks, but that's fine. Gillian Anderson was incredible. It's an utterly bizarre character because she talks like Dolly Parton in 9 to 5. She looks like Norma Desmond from Sunset Boulevard, even though that kind of costuming makes absolutely no sense for a actress from an 80s horror franchise, but like, whatever. There's not a lot of logic in this film, and that's not a bad thing.
No, I think one of its greatest strengths is that it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you shouldn't try to find the logic of this movie. It is a vibes film. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of heady topics having to do with sexuality and gender, but the kind of the story mechanism, once you get to Camp Miasma, it's better to just unplug your brain and look at the gorgeous visuals. We have not talked about the TV show The Shards. We plan to do our own VIP episode because Chelsea and I promise that we're going to finish the book, The Shards, and the series and talk about it all together. But from what I've seen of The Shards, it is the problem of shooting a series set 40 years ago, 30 years ago, with people who have fillers and Instagram face. This is sort of the opposite of that issue. Some of the best casting of people of today looking like people from the 80s, because within this film is the Camp Miasma film.
Yeah, and there's a point in this movie where a lot of time is devoted to a scene from the movie. I wanted to know, what did you think of the Long December sequence, which was a mass murder?
Yes, that is orchestrated to a needle drop of the Counting Crows' Long December.
I think they played the entire song. It was very, very long.
Yes, which doesn't make sense because it's a song from the 90s. So it's not something that is a contemporary song to the 2020s. Nor was it a song that existed in the 80s when this movie came out. Nor does it make sense because this is about camp counselors during the summertime.
Totally. It's a very deliberately wrong choice of song. I don't know if it totally worked. I'm into ironic music usage or a sort of off song choice, but I feel like there should be something conceptually within the song that relates in some way. And that song, I mean, Long December, first of all, I mean, for me, I just can't divorce that song from the visuals that that song conjures up for me of Los Angeles. Specifically, you know, it's such a visual song. The smell of hospitals in winter.
However, because it is such a specific choice that is incongruous to the visuals and the context of the scene, I'm like, the director must have had a reason to put this in. And that, I think, goes for a lot of the movie where it's like, this clearly had such a long thought process that I may not understand, but I trust you and I'm going to go with it.
Totally. I appreciated how audacious it was, certainly.
Well, I do think that that music cue in this movie is still in theaters. If you haven't seen it, I think you should go to the theater and see this movie. So we won't get into that much of the plot. But that is certainly this kind of halfway point in the movie where the structure of reality starts to break down. Certainly the visuals of this mass murder scene, we should say, of the little death is the killer of the Camp Miasma films, is so the type of murder rampage you would see in a early aughts horror film. And you have this song from the 90s, but it's a recreation of a film, or it's this is supposed to be a film from the 80s that we're watching at this point in the movie, that I think it's just, it's trying to break you of the reality and prepare you for what you're about to see for the next 20, 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
If you are scared by horror films, this is an anti-horror film, a meta-horror film.
Yeah.
You know, like New Nightmare by Frightmaster Wes Craven, which is maybe my favorite line in the film, which is this off-reference line in the hellish Zoom meeting with the creative executives.
Where Dylan Baker does some incredible work. We obviously love him from Happiness, but he does a lot with a very short scene that is entirely on Zoom.
Yeah, he does a lot in that Zoom window. So yeah, every outfit approved?
Definitely. I thought it was very fun. And also, Hannah Einbinder's tits. Oh my God. I was like not prepared. Incredible.
You do see Hannah Einbinder's
perfect breasts.
You see her luscious, luscious tits that I guess she was hiding under hoodies during the run of Hacks.
Yeah. Who knew? Anyway, we're ending this on a perverted note. Shall we get into Tony?
Absolutely. Matt Johnson, the director of Blackberries, follow-up to that film. His first American film, I learned. He is a Canadian, and all of his movies have been Canadian productions. He did kind of a biopic. If Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma is an anti-horror film, Matt Johnson's Tony is kind of an anti-biopic.
Well, there is a precedent of biopics that are set to a more condensed period of time.
Right. So this is a film about Anthony Bourdain, his time the summer after his first year at Vassar College, where he ends up in Provincetown. I don't know what you took away from the film, but what I got was that this is a Provincetown where it's predominantly straight people and Anthony Bourdain did not have sex once during the summertime. That's what I was supposed to understand from this movie, right?
No, I was very surprised by that also. Like when he first got there, you saw two guys kissing, I think, for a second. And you did see like an older gay guy like briefly order a slice of pizza at Spiritus. But like there were not like gay people in this movie.
And there was a lesbian reveal at the end of the film as well. So we've got five gay people.
Yeah. It just to me seems unrealistic that not one person in this kitchen is gay. Because Provincetown is a seasonal town that runs on seasonal labor. And a lot of people that want to spend a summer working in Provincetown in exchange for room and board are gay people that want to go there because it's a gay vacation town, which is not to say that it's not a diverse place. There's always been straight people there. Chloe 70 recently purchased a house in Provincetown.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. And even the story that we're following of Anthony Bourdain, Dominic Sessa plays young Anthony Bourdain. He is trading his services as a dishwasher for room and board at Antonio Banderas's place. Well,
does that even qualify as room and board? Because he's literally sleeping in a hammock outside on Antonio Banderas's deck.
Yeah, for plot reasons, I get why he has to sleep out on the hammock for the entire summer. But it does seem like he could have upgraded his accommodations at a certain point.
Yeah. Antonio Banderas was wonderful in this. He's always so wonderful to watch on screen. We're so lucky to have him. Although when I saw the character that he was based on at the very end, because they showed a photo of like the real guy, I was like, oh, they made him a lot hotter, like really a lot hotter.
Well, yes, of course. And Matt Johnson, one of the co-writers and the director of this film, said that it's an amalgamation of many of Anthony Bourdain's mentors.
And they were all extremely, extremely hot. Like, it is kind of strange to randomly throw such a hot person in here and have it be kind of unacknowledged.
How attractive Antonio Banderas is. And yet he basically crashed out as a chef at different restaurants and ended up having a sort of a clam shack. The Clam Shack lobster roll place in Provincetown. Is that a real restaurant that they shot in?
The Antonio Banderas restaurant?
Yeah.
I'd have no idea.
You have frequented Provincetown from time to time. The pizza shop is real.
The pizza shop, I have spent a lot of time in the pizza shop because even though Provincetown is a party town, the bars have to close at 1. But Spiritus, this pizza place, which is in the middle of Commercial Street, closes at 2. So what happens is that everyone comes out of the bars and goes there and stands outside eating pizza and smoking and stuff. And then you go home after, you go to the Dick Dock, whatever. But
I'm sorry, the Dick Dock?
Yeah, the Dick Dock. It's just like a sort of cruising dock.
Oh, yes.
Down the way.
That dock is featured in this film. Seems to be less of a... This is the other erasure of homosexuality in this movie, is like the dock is presented as the place that you score heroin.
Okay, there's multiple docks. Okay. There's more than one dock.
Okay, sorry. In the movie, we saw the heroin dock, the dick dock, separate
dock. The dick
dock
is another dock. It's a different dock.
I wonder how many people who see this movie have no idea who Anthony Bourdain is, because I think one of the greatest functions of this movie is if you go in cold, if you somehow don't know who Anthony Bourdain is, it's just a solid coming of age film.
Yeah, I enjoyed this movie. I'm not someone that knows a ton about Anthony Bourdain, but I found it to be fascinating.
See, I'm one of those people who has a parasocial relationship with Anthony Bourdain. I loved all of his shows. Not for nothing, I did find him incredibly attractive. In seeing this movie, it made me go back and watch old episodes of No Reservation, and then the 2021 doc Roadrunner, which is about his life, that a lot of people in his circle and a lot of people who worked on No Reservations and Parts Unknown participated in.
Yes, I watched that last night. Because obviously, when he died, I learned more about Anthony Bourdain, certainly, because it got so much news and the circumstances of his death were so fucked up and twisted, but Roadrunner was great. He's just a truly unique person. There's no one else like that. And I agree with you. He's really hot. And the way that he looks in clothes in that movie is just, it's just like incredible. It's like, fuck, that's how a blazer should look on a man. That's how jeans should fit a man.
Well, he was always incredibly slender, which makes me think of your commentary about Ted Danson.
Yeah, when you're thin and tall like that, but also kind of squarish and masculine, and it's just an incredible way to look, especially when you add in the details of the cigarettes and that sort of thing. You know, he has a rock star quality, clearly, and there were many rock stars in that film.
Yeah. So the movie is inspired by his own book called Kitchen Confidential, which is how he rose to fame after, I mean, he refers to himself this way in the Roadrunner documentary, a middling line cook. And he writes this book, Kitchen Confidential. He first writes an essay in the New Yorker that gets the attention of a publisher. And then he writes about his tales in the kitchen in this book. It becomes a bestseller. He gets a show out of that. But Tony sent me down a rabbit hole going back to Kitchen Confidential. And it made me realize that there was a TV show based on his book, Kitchen Confidential, which came out in the mid-2000s, because a lot of people have a parasocial relationship with Anthony Bourdain, more so in his death, post-death. But a lot of people have been like, Tony would have hated this movie. And people have been posting like, I don't know, he was cool with Bradley Cooper playing him in a Darren Star-produced version, sitcom version of Kitchen Confidential.
I can't believe Darren Star did that. I love the Sex and the City connection here. We brought it back.
If you look hard enough, all roads lead back to Sex and the City. It's such a bizarre time period in Bradley Cooper's career because it's like pre-Hangover. He's still very much
post-Sex in the City.
Post-Sex in the City.
Wait, is that how Darren Star knew him?
I don't know. The show lasted half a season, so we didn't get great panel talks about why Darren Star cast Bradley Cooper in that television series.
Truly the strangest person to cast is Anthony Bourdain, just because his physicality is relevant, I think.
And I think Dominic Sessa, quite like Hannah Einbinder, kind of typecast in these past two roles that we know both of them for. But like, he played a sullen youth in The Holdovers, and now he's a slightly older sullen youth. Like, if you didn't know that this was an Anthony Bourdain biopic about his early years, you'd just be like, oh, this feels like a spiritual sequel to The Holdovers.
Yeah, I think that it was so smart that they approached his life in this way and condensed the time period. Because when I think about biopics that I actually like, or biopics that like can pass as real movies, does that make any sense?
It does. I do know what you're saying, because it's funny. Walk Hard came out, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, which was satirizing all of the biopics that came before it, most specifically Walk the Line, of like, this is what is wrong with this genre of film. So much so, and these tropes are done so many times that we can make a comedy about it. And Hollywood went, okay, great, we'll keep making movies like that.
Well, recently we have gotten Spencer, the Princess Diana biopic with Kristen Stewart, which I thought was great, which was condensed to a very short period of time.
A weekend, in that case.
A weekend. I mean, we've had films like Gus Van Sant's Last Days, which was a thinly veiled Kurt Cobain movie, again, condensed to like a 3-day time period, I think.
We're getting this Chris Hansen movie.
This Chris Hansen movie, yes.
But yeah, I know what you're saying about this movie feels like a real movie. As I was kind of saying earlier, it's a film that stands on its own outside of it's so gross to say that it this way, but you know, it's IP, which is everyone loves Anthony Bourdain.
Its IP wasn't used at all. It was only in the last scene where he says his full name.
I know. It's very, you don't watch movies like The Avengers, but it's like very superhero coded where it's like, call me by my real name. Anthony Bourdain. I did love the final scene of the film when he is interviewing at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. Very funny scene about the confusion over that with Antonio Banderas earlier in the movie. But Anthony Bourdain's real-life friend, Eric Repair, who is the chef behind Le Bernardin, home of Carrie's favorite chocolate souffle. Which also this movie made me think of that. It's the episode, it's season 3 somewhere. I think it's episode 8 where Carrie's like, the things that New Yorkers are willing to wait for. And it's like the perfect rent control department, the chocolate souffle at Le Bernardin, and then, I don't know, something that has to do with Aiden. But Eric Repair appears as one of the, not judges, but like one of the chefs who's interviewing Tony at the end of the film.
Yeah, one of his chef overlords.
So I thought that that was a very cute touchstone. It feels so weird to be like an Easter egg when you're talking about someone's life. But I think that gets to the heart of the relationship that a lot of people had to the person and the persona of Anthony Bourdain, where I instantly was like, that's Eric Repaire. That's his friend. They met on No Reservations. And sadly, that is who he was with when Anthony Bourdain died by suicide in 2018.
Yeah, he's also in Roadrunner.
The documentary Roadrunner.
Which was a fascinating watch. It is on HBO Max. So if you haven't seen it, definitely recommend. It's an incredible character study of this man, although certainly tragic. Do we want to get into the Ozio Argento of it all?
We can do that. I mean, it's an interesting double feature to go see Tony and then watch the documentary Roadrunner, because the sensitivity that Matt Johnson has to Anthony Bourdain, I thought was very restrained, very respectful. Because the title card at the end of the film does not go cradle to grave. It just is like he got into the Culinary Institute.
The title card at the end of Tony.
Yes.
Just want to clarify.
Sorry. Not the documentary. And then you go and watch the documentary, and obviously that is more of a cradle to grave, quite literally, portrait of Anthony Bourdain's life and how, you know, he did not find fame until much, much later in life. Like, Anthony Bourdain is a year younger than my parents.
Wow.
And his book came out in 26 years ago, and then he got the show. But, you know, what I took away, because it was the second time I watched the documentary, was this imposter syndrome that he felt of he was almost trapped by the fame and this idea that everyone looked at him because he traveled the world and ate food and made great television, that you have the best job in the world. And it's like he didn't know how to stop doing that.
Yeah, there are some people that really do not have the correct temperament for fame. And he did, in the sense that, like, you see him in this documentary and he's kind, obviously, on his television shows. He's very good at connecting with people. But at a point, he got so famous and just started to feel claustrophobic and literally started to become a bit agoraphobic, which is how he described himself.
And Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age, who became Anthony Bourdain's friend, was featured on the Joshua Tree episode of the show. And they play a segment from that episode in the documentary Roadrunner. And he has this great line of, like, nothing feels better than going home and nothing feels better than leaving home. And I think one of the narratives of the documentary is Anthony Bourdain felt trapped by that dichotomy.
He felt trapped by the fame, but he always had demons. There was always a level of darkness within him. And we see this in Tony. And I think there are certain people that just have a kind of baseline of discomfort with the world. And oftentimes those people turn to drugs, and he was a former drug addict, a recovering drug addict.
Which is another thing that the film Tony takes a more restrained view on, where if you watch the Roadrunner documentary, there's an episode of, I think it was No Reservations, or maybe it was Parts Unknown, where he goes back to Provincetown, and he was like, yeah, I was fully a heroin addict here.
Yeah.
Which is not something that is depicted in the film. It's touched upon, but
it's touched upon, and we see him getting blackout drunk. We see him doing coke and stuff, but
I'm sure that's a hard thing to get your head around, where one of his most famous episodes of No Reservations is this episode that they did in Beirut, Lebanon, while an act of war is happening. They did not know that when they first traveled to Beirut. They got stuck. And in the documentary, you hear the producers talk about how Anthony Bourdain was like, we're never airing this episode. And they did. And it's not mentioned in the documentary, but he won an Emmy for that episode. So I'm sure that must have been so confusing to see all of this human suffering. And then he's the one who gets rewarded for that.
Yeah, it seems like those sort of issues around exploitation was something that he personally struggled with.
And something that is explored later in the documentary is just his addictive personality. sometimes, as it's phrased in the documentary, was used for good, whether it was making the best show possible, being the best father possible, being the best jiu-jitsu fighter possible. Yes. Sometimes he focuses attention on, how you want to phrase it, the wrong things.
Yeah, of course. Well, he became obsessed with the actress Azio Argento, who he was dating.
Who I think he met through the show.
You know, some people do use people as substances, you know. That is why those sex and love addicts meetings continue to thrive.
And the documentary does not outright say that Azio Argento is responsible for Anthony Bourdain's death, but...
Nor are we suggesting that she is, but he was a mentally unstable person that sort of ideated about suicide for, you know, a long time, predating that.
As many people do. But I think there's something about the Roadrunner documentary where it is unprecedented B-roll that you see of the making of his shows over the years that the producers gave to this director. And at the very least, what we see is how unstable Anthony Bourdain became towards the end. And it happened to coincide with his relationship of Azio Argento. And he became infatuated with her. Like, one of my favorite people that's interviewed in that documentary is one of the producers or the camera guy in talking about, even as benign as it could be, his obsessiveness of like, I don't practice Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, I can't hear you talk about this for 2 hours. And this guy also talks about how he would just talk about how great of a parallel parker Azio Argento is. And they show the footage and she's just, you can see her sort of disassociating or like getting the ick from Anthony Bourdain of like, why are you talking about me parallel parking for so long?
Totally. And she's also an intense person. You know, I know that just from seeing her movies. Did you ever see Scarlet Diva?
No.
That was her first sort of semi-autobiographical, very horny movie, dark movie that she directed and starred in. And then after that, she did The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things, which she also directed and starred in.
Right. And this is now going back nearly 10 years. Azio Argento is one of the first people who came out and spoke about being sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. She was one of kind of the avatars of the Me Too movement. That's something that Anthony Bourdain took on, which I had forgotten about how in front of this issue he was.
Yeah, I never saw any of those media appearances. So this was news to me.
And obviously, post Anthony Bourdain's death, Azio Argento went through her own controversy stemming from that J.T. Leroy film that you just mentioned and her sexual relationship with her underage co-star who played her son.
It wasn't during the time of the film. During the time of the film, he was a child. She then instigated a sexual relationship with him when he was 17, so still underage. Not good, deeply fucked up. Kind of power imbalance that would happen if the director of the film that you shot when you were a kid. I mean, it's extremely twisted and fucked up and dark. And there was some sort of settlement, I recall, that she paid to him that I mean, did Anthony Bourdain pay that? That's the other thing.
Yeah. Did that happen before or after?
I think it happened before. I think he was still around for that.
Anyway, this is all stuff that I remember at the time that I think was just so incredibly dark, I blocked it out of my memory.
Yeah. The whole thing is like the most depraved, fucked up shit I've ever heard about in my life.
Anyway, Tony is a delight.
Tony doesn't get into any of that stuff.
And it is much better for that. I also want to recommend Matt Johnson, who directed this movie and, as I said, previously directed Blackberry, which is great. But he made a movie with his best friend last year called Nirvana, the Band, the Movie. And I didn't understand what it was about at the time. And then I watched it this past weekend and it is so genius, Chelsea. Hear me out. It's a time travel movie.
Okay.
But Matt Johnson and his friend Jay McCarroll, who did the music for Tony.
The music was great.
Had a web series in the late 2000s. And Matt Johnson had his editor go through hundreds of hours of footage that they shot back in like 2008, pulled the best footage. And then they wrote a movie about that. So there are scenes that I truly don't know how they did this, where them in the present are speaking to them in 2008. And because they wrote the script around all of this old footage they had, it makes perfect sense.
That's cool.
It's very cool. It is on Disney or Hulu, whatever streaming service you have.
Okay. We'll watch.
This was a more depressing episode than I thought it was going to be.
I know. I'm sorry, guys. Yeah, I didn't think it would get this dark. So I guess we've got to call it.
Before we say our goodbyes, I just want to say that next week is going to be a mailbag / hotline episode. So please call in with your relationship quandaries, boots on the ground anecdotes, style questions, things we haven't talked about on the podcast that you'd like our opinion on. As always, we would appreciate keeping these calls to a minute or under. Our hotline number is 323-486-6773.
We will be back next week. Let's hope that no one cool dies.
We would like to have at least one positive episode of the Every Outfit podcast.
I'll try and manifest that.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.